University of Basel. So please.
Okay, let me start by thanking the organizers for the kind invitation. And in this talk today, I will try to show that using trapped ions as a physical platform, we can simulate one of the most important problems or processes in solid-state systems, that's the small pore formation. I should not forget to mention that this work was done in collaboration with Ignacio Sirac's group. His name, for totally different reasons, appears on this first slide, but let me not forget to mention this. Okay, let me start by briefly remind you of the general idea of quantum simulations. This idea is due to Feynman, who in 1981 was contemplating what would it be like to simulate a complex quantum system with another system which is easier to manipulate and measure instead of simulating it on a classical computer. In hindsight, this idea is, of course, totally justified because even the most powerful classical computers we have nowadays cannot treat much more than, say, 40 to 42 spin 1/2 particles. In any case, this idea of using one system to emulate another is what we nowadays call analog quantum simulation. And this is precisely what I will focus on in the main part of my talk. Besides, Feynman was also thinking about the possibility of universal quantum simulators, that is, systems that could be reprogrammed at will to simulate just about any quantum system rather than one particular instance. And this was proven in 1996 to be possible by Lloyd, although for a restricted class of systems with short-range interactions. And this led to the concept of digital quantum simulation. So in digital quantum simulation, the time evolution operator of an arbitrary system with short-range interactions can always be decomposed through a set of elementary unitaries or quantum gates to be carried out on one of these universal simulators. So you could say that these simulators, universal simulators, are some sort of special purpose quantum computers. Then this recent resurgence of interest in quantum simulation probably has something to do with the much smaller physical resources, meaning system size, that we need for quantum simulations, especially their analog, compared to what we need for quantum computation. So for a full-fledged quantum computation, we will need at some point hundreds or thousands of qubits, while in analog quantum simulation, we are getting somewhere with much smaller system size. And this is especially true if you use trapped ions as a platform. As Professor Milburn explained a week ago, these systems have been around for more than half a century now, and the methods of trapping, cooling, and methods for all measurements of all kinds have been developed to a very high degree. In fact, so much so that the Nobel Prize awarded to David Vineland last year had to do much to do with these developments. In particular, trapping is nowadays typically done using a combination of a static and a radio frequency electric field. These are the so-called RF traps. As far as cooling is concerned, again, this is something that Professor Milburn already explained, but it's usually done in two stages, where in the Doppler cooling stage, we can bring the system to a state with a few motional quanta, meaning quanta of nearly harmonic vibrations of all the ions. And then if you really want to bring the system to the motional ground state, we use the so-called resolved sideband cooling. Internal states of ions are usually identified through fluorescence-type measurements, and this is nowadays done with nearly 100% precision. The errors are something like 10 to minus 4. And what is particularly useful about these internal states is that we can always think of them as components of pseudospins. In fact, even in this talk, this will be the case. And this explains why many of the quantum simulations with trapped ions suggested so far are those dedicated to quantum spin systems. Incidentally, many of them are covered in this recent review article, which I can warmly recommend. Then on the technological side, in recent years, there has been a tendency to shift from these traps of this kind, where we have multiple ions in the same trapping region. These are usually called linear RF traps, to systems of this kind, the so-called arrays of microfabricated traps, where each ion has its own trapping region. And then these different trapping regions or microtraps are at a typical distance of a few micrometers. Now, not only that the efforts are underway at this moment to make these arrays even in two dimensions, But there's another reason to for switching to these kind of systems, namely these so-called linear RF traps have the problem of structural instability towards so-called zigzag configuration if the array is too long, so to speak. So these arrays of microtraps will, okay, hopefully open the opportunity for many new quantum simulation proposals, but will eventually be even much more important for quantum computation, where the scalability is a much much more critical issue. Okay, after this introduction on trap times, which is intentionally relatively short, I would like to give a longer introduction on polarons and small polarons, especially because most of the people in the audience, I think, are not from the solid state community. So imagine that we inject an extra electron or a hole into a crystal of a narrowband semiconductor or an insulator. Now, the presence of this carrier will cause a shift in the equilibrium positions of the surrounding atoms of the host crystal. And this, in turn, creates a net potential acting on this carrier. If this potential is strong enough, it can lead to a heavy dressing of this carrier by a cloud of virtual phonons. And Landau was the first one to study such carriers in polar semiconductors. And then for this reason only, he called them polarons, the name that then stuck for the next 8 decades. In particular, if the size of the phonon cloud around the carrier is not larger than 1 unit cell of the host crystal, then we talk about small polarons. And here I quoted the definition of a small polaron by David Emin, one of the experts in the field. And so the only thing I could possibly object to in this definition is the use of the word localized, which I think could be somewhat misleading here. Namely, in this polaron problem, there's nothing like breaking of the discrete lattice translational symmetry. So in other words, there's no localization in the true sense of the word taking place here. What happens is that these carriers acquire effective mass which are much larger than the bare band mass of, so the band mass of bare electrons. And for this reason, their kinetic energy is heavily suppressed compared to that of bare electrons, sometimes even exponentially. It's important to stress that the quantum states of these polarons are full-fledged block states like those of bare electrons. Okay, now if we want to put things in a slightly more formal footing, coupled electron phonon systems are described by Hamiltonians of this sort, where we have an electron term, phonon term, and a coupling or electron phonon term. Now, no matter what is the actual form of this coupling term, the total Hamiltonian has to commute with this so-called total crystal momentum operator.
I have a question. Yes? So is this like acoustic phonons or
any phonons? This, at this point, it's completely general, actually. But most of the time, these small polarons will show up in systems that have short-range interaction to actually optical phonons. In, for small polarons, I'm talking about small polarons.
Your previous slides, you mentioned the first one was actually mentioned by Landau.
Those were polar optical phonons in polar semiconductors. Yes. Okay. In any case, these two operators always commute, and their joint eigenstates are then the block states of the coupled electron phonon systems. Needless to say, these block states are not the same as the block states of bare electrons. And the quantity which actually tells us how different these two types of block states are is called quasi-particle residue or spectral weight, which is nothing but the module squared of the overlap of these two types of block states at the same quasi-momentum in the Brillouin zone. Now, the Z is close to 1 for a weakly coupled system, and it's close to 0 for small polarons. Okay, now if you want a little more intuitive picture of what small polaron is, I think this energy diagram will help. So first of all, the center of the small polaron block band is shifted downwards from that of a bare electron by the amount called polaron binding energy. And then the width of the small polaron band is much, much smaller than that of a bare electron. It can be as small as 1 millielectron volt in real materials. Now, the necessary condition for small polaron formation is that this binding energy is at least as big as the half of the bare electron bandwidth. Now, if you think what this condition actually implies in the light of these two previous considerations, it actually implies that the energetic overlap of the small polaron band and the bare electron band from which it emerged is very small, or even zero. Okay, let me sketch here what I mean. Say, if this is our bare electron band, so the condition is that this binding energy is at least as big as the half of the bare electron bandwidth. And so the center of the small positron band is here. So because its width is relatively small, it can have at most very small energetic overlap with the bare electron band. And I hope this explains why then the small positron band is a totally different band from the bare electron band it transpired from. Okay, now, as I said, small positrons emerge in systems with short-range electron-photon coupling. And such coupling is usually explained, usually modeled within the framework of this molecular crystal model, which envisions, say, fermionic particle hopping on a lattice with certain hopping amplitude, T, and each site of such a lattice hosting a completely dispersionless, or Einstein photon mode. Then two main mechanisms of short-range interaction are the following. The first one is a so-called local or Holstein type coupling, whereby electronic on-site energy becomes effectively linearly dependent on the local oscillator displacement. Then the second mechanism is a slightly non-local, yet still short-ranged, Pyrrhus type coupling, where our hopping amplitude between two sites becomes linearly dependent on the difference of the oscillator displacement on these two sites. Now, if you actually quantize these oscillators into phonons and introduce these dimensionless couplings G and phi, then you can write the corresponding coupling terms in these forms here. And I want to call your attention to this first Holstein coupling term, which will be important for the remaining part of this talk. This coupling term is strictly local in the sense that it couples electron bilinear operator electron or fermion density at site I with the phonon displacement on that site only. Okay, now why is it challenging in general to study, at least quantitatively study, coupled electron-phonon systems? The simple answer is because of the size of the Hilbert space. Remember that phonons have, in principle, infinite Hilbert spaces. And although methods do exist to truncate them to finite size in a controllable fashion, these remaining truncated Hilbert spaces are still pretty big. For instance, in a molecular crystal model with six sites and, say, the total of 10 phonons, we have Hilbert space with dimension larger than 18,000. And another important thing is the phonon distribution in the ground state of a coupled system. This distribution peaks at zero phonons in the weak coupling regime, for instance, this blue curve here. And it typically peaks at three or four phonons at the onset of strong coupling regime where the small positrons set in. Now, because of this, as I said, huge size of the typical Hilbert spaces we are dealing with here, we have to find an alternative to exact diagonalizations to treat these systems. And one very successful alternative is this Toyozawa-type variational ansatz. So these ansatz states, of course, have to be of the general block form, as written here, where these Vanier-like function psi kappa of n depend on two sets of variational parameters. These phi parameters here describe the broadening of the fermion wave function away from the site n, while the v's here actually parameterize coherent states, phonon coherent states, which are here used as a basis for the phonon part of the wave, this polaron wave function. Yes.
I have a question. Yes. So while it's true that the overall open space is very large, if you're restricting yourself to thinking about a pure state, then you have some entangled state, then the Schmidt number of the entangled state can never be bigger than the smaller dimensional space. So I can't really access, I mean, depends.
But you don't know which states are,
it's
right.
It's true.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah.
So, I mean, I guess this variational ansatz is kind of like a Schmidt, it only is sum over one index, so it's not necessarily the Schmidt decomposition, but it's
definitely a highly entangled state of electrons and phonons, yes. Okay, now what is important for the rest of this talk is that in the case of Holstein model, this ansatz actually becomes exact in the unphysical limit of the vanishing hopping amplitude. But this also means that it is at its best in the physical regime where this hopping amplitude is much more than the phonon frequency, and that is called anti-adiabatic regime of the Holstein model. Now, as you will see shortly, this is precisely the regime that we encounter in this quantum simulation with trapped ions. Okay, so our paper describing this quantum simulation of small holes in Poland was published about 3 months ago, where my collaborators were postdoc Tao Shi and Ignacio Sirak from the MPQ in Garching, and my boss Christo Bruder from Basel. So to reiterate, our goal in this work was to simulate the Holstein model with emphasis on a strong coupling regime where small polarons set in, and all that using a linear array of ion microtraps. I should emphasize that this was in fact not the first proposal to simulate coupled electron-phonon systems. There were at least two that I'm aware of before. But first of all, these two works were envisioning the use of different physical platforms, the first one called polar molecules and the second one Rydberg atoms and ions. Also, they didn't have exactly the same goals as we had in mind. And there were several issues that we thought were among the most important, which in these works were not treated in a very rigorous fashion, probably because of the kind of weaknesses of these physical platforms that they had in mind. And some of these issues I listed here. First of all, if we want to simulate Holstein model, we really want to realize tricky local coupling of phonons to an itinerant excitation. Then a necessary prerequisite for this is to make phonons as dispersionless as possible. Of course, totally dispersionless phonons, meaning phonons that are totally localized in real space, are an idealization. But of course, one can always try to get as close as possible to this ideal situation. And then the third thing, was to reach a strong coupling regime with realistic values of experimental parameters. This is something that actually in advance we didn't even know whether it's possible, but fortunately it turned out to really be conceivable in this trapped ion setup. Okay, here is the sketch of our actual system. We have, as I said, linear array of ion microtraps, which is subject to three pairs of counter-propagating laser beams. Each of these pairs gives rise to a standing wave, and the standing waves are slightly off-resonant with respect to this internal transition of these ions. For reasons that I hope will become clear shortly, our ions are assumed to have four internal states. Okay, now, rather than going through all the algebra, I want to explain the central physical mechanism that makes this simulation possible. In fact, not only this simulation, but many other. This is coupling of internal states to motion, which is based on this idea proposed by Porras and Sirak in 2004. And the basic mechanism is the following. If you shine standing laser wave, which is onto a, say, two-level system, and if this wave is slightly detuned from an internal transition, then it will lead to a position and state-dependent conservative potential called AC Stark shift. Now, this potential is proportional to the square of this position and state-dependent coupling constant omega, and it's inversely proportional to the detuning delta between the laser frequency and the internal frequency, internal transition frequency. In particular, in this so-called Lamb-Dickey regime, and this is the regime where the size of the trapped ground state is much smaller than the laser wavelength, you can expand this coupling constant around the ion equilibrium positions to linear order and get coupling Hamiltonian like this, where now qi alpha are the displacements of different ions in the direction alpha from the equilibrium positions. And sigma is the pseudo spin 1/2 that corresponds to the lowest two internal states. Remember, I said that we started with ions that have four internal states. And the question is, where did the two higher internal states disappear? Well, basically, they are inherent to this process of generating AC Stark shift. In this process in which you effectively get this conservative potential, you are adiabatically eliminating the higher two internal states. So you end up with this pseudo spin 1/2 describing just the lowest two internal states. This constant F here is called pushing force, and it is proportional to the square of the Rabi frequency and the laser wave number. Now, at this point, there's only one more thing to do in order to arrive at a Holstein-like coupling Hamiltonian, namely, pseudospin 1/2 can always be mapped into spinless fermions using this well-known Jordan-Wigner mapping. And if we also quantize these phonon displacements here, then we really arrive at local Holstein-like coupling of these spinless fermions to phonon modes. Now, if you remember the description of the molecular crystal model, we really want to couple our fermionic particles to only one flavor of phonons, while in this case we have at least longitudinal and transverse phonons. So we somehow want to reduce our system to only to having only one flavor of phonons. And in order to describe how we actually do this, let me remind you that in this system, all the vibrational modes result from the competition of the trapping potentials and Coulomb repulsion. Well, trapping potentials tend to give the phonon modes spatially localized characters, while the Coulomb repulsion tends to delocalize them, to give them a highly collective character. So first of all, we want to always be, for all both transverse and longitudinal modes, we want to be in this so-called stiff limit, given by this inequality, which actually says that the trapping potential dominates over Coulomb repulsion. And then we can eliminate the high-energy transverse phonon modes through a canonical, imperturbatively through something like a Froehlich-like canonical transformation. In that way, we arrive at an effective Hamiltonian of the system, whose phonon part is then described only by longitudinal phonons and has this form here. One thing that I did not show on this slide is that in this process of deriving effective Hamiltonian, we also generate coupling between the X and Y components of the pseudospins, like X-Y coupling. And this translated to the spinless fermion language just means hopping of this spinless fermion. So this is another term of the Holstein model. In any case, let me focus on the form of this longitudinal phonon Hamiltonian. So here, this first term is, so to say, what we want to have. It's the term which on its own would give you completely dispersionless phonons, except that this frequency omega z tilde is slightly renormalized from the original phonon frequency omega z. And then the second term is actually the one that sets the width of the phonon dispersion. This is the one that we want to eliminate to as large an extent as possible. And if you now impose the condition that the width of this phonon band is much smaller than the bare excitation bandwidth, plus combine this with conditions under which this mentioned perturbative elimination of the transverse phonons is allowed, then you arrive at this kind of condition under which we can have nearly dispersionless phonons. So we are restricted to the regime where J, which is here the hopping amplitude of the bare excitation, has to be much smaller than the longitudinal phonon frequency. As I said, this was precisely the regime where this Toyozawa variational ansatz is at its best, which was kind of very fortunate here. And okay, then under all these conditions, one arrives at this kind of Holstein-like coupling term, where this dimensionless coupling constant G is given in terms of system parameters in the following way, where, again, to remind you, G is the Rabi frequency, delta is the tuning, A is the size of the trapped ground state, which is in the nanometer region, and D0 is distance between nearest neighbor ions, which is something of the order of micrometer.
So in this case, yeah. For example, in your equation in the center, the beta z is also much smaller than 1. Is that
yes, right? Yes. All betas are much smaller than 1. So we are always in the stiff limit for in all three spatial directions. But this is not, for our purpose, not sufficient to be for the longitudinal phonons. We want to be even more rigorous than that. We want to really get as close as possible to the dispersionless phonon regime. Okay, and here are some typical values of these parameters. Now, as it turns out, without even pushing to the extreme values of experimental parameters, we can really sweep through the full smooth crossover from a quasi-free excitation, for which the Z factor is close to 1 and the average number of phonons is close to 0, to a small polaron for which Z's factor is close to 0 and the average number of phonons is bigger than about 3. And shown here are results from Toyozawa ansatz calculation on 32 sites, where, as I said, for reasons I just explained, J is kept at a very small value of only 25 kilohertz. And, one comment about the system size. Actually, system size is not really a critical issue. Probably experiments are still not in the regime where they can do 32 microtraps. But the results on a system of size 5 with 5 sites would be very similar. I mean, that's a kind of accepted thing in the polaron studies. that the system size, it does not play a crucial role here. Okay, so shown here is the dependence on the z factor on this ratio that actually determines the value of the coupling constant. And we can see that for different possible longitudinal phonon frequencies, we can reach we can really reach z's that are almost arbitrarily close to zero. And as I said, even without pushing to the extreme values of parameters, for instance, with these typical values of g and delta that I just mentioned in the previous slide, this exit should actually go to 10. But we can get z's very close to zero already for values which are, say, 1 or 1.5. And likewise, for the average number of phonons in the ground state, not only that it can be bigger than 3, but as you can see here, it can easily be bigger than even 5. So we can even get pretty deep into the strong coupling regime characterized by small phonons. Okay, now let's assume that I at least partially convinced you that our envisioned setup really simulates small Hoeffding phonons. And if I didn't, you can always look up our paper. But to end with, I would like to mention two problems that are, I think, very interesting and important in solid-state physics, and that could potentially be now studied experimentally with this setup once hopefully realized. And the first one is actually behavior of small photons in the high-density limit, what I call here multiple excitation regime. So what happens if you increase the number of these fermionic excitations? They will then have less and less phonons to make their phonon clouds. And at some critical density, you expect to get sort of unbinding transition from the small poron states to quasi-free particle states. Now, this process, in principle, is known as density-driven destabilization of small porons. But this critical density at which this happens is not easy to calculate theoretically, and also not easy to extract from, say, solid-state experiments, because there, first of all, you cannot just control the number of these carriers very easily. That's one reason. And the second reason is that in solid-state systems, electron-phonon interaction is always accompanied by other types of interaction, like electron-electron interaction. So you cannot, it's very hard to study the intrinsic effects of electron-phonon interaction. So the idea would be to use this kind of setup to actually experimentally determine this kind of critical density at which this unbinding happens. And for that, one would need to measure these quantities I mentioned, like residue and average number of phonons. For instance, it seems that this average number of phonons is a kind of a routine measurement in this trapped ion community. They do it using Raman transitions. And so one would just need to verify that by increasing number of excitations at some critical density, your average number of phonons suddenly starts to go down, and your quasi-particle residue starts to go up. That would be one important problem. And then the other important problem, maybe even actually more important, is the non-equilibrium aspect of small poron physics, namely the dynamics of small poron formation. In other words, it would be very useful to be able to answer this question: how rapidly, upon creation of a bare excitation, or if you want, excitation phonon interaction quench, the cloud of virtual phonons around it forms. So this question was not studied in great detail yet, even theoretically. In fact, I'm aware only of one paper which is somewhat inconclusive. And in a similar way as this, for similar reasons as this previous problem, this is also difficult to answer in the say from solid state experiments. First of all, the issue is that the frequencies involved in, for instance, phonon frequencies involved in solid state experiments are far higher. They're in the terahertz regime, while here we have megahertz. And in accordance with that, the relevant dynamical timescales in solid state systems are so much shorter by many orders of magnitude. And so this information is not so easy to extract even from ultra-fast time-resolved studies. While here in this cold world of atoms and ions, energies are small, timescales are long, and I think the hope to extract, answer this kind of question is much better. Yes. Okay, thank you for your attention.
We have a few questions, more questions, yes.
How important is it that this takes place on a lattice? Because you can also realize a dispersion is polaron, I guess, having, or this is a question, can you realize a dispersion is polaron, i.e. your problem, by having a heavy atom in a Bose-Einstein condensate where the phonons are the Kuiper modes?
In principle, yeah, that's a different kind of, that's totally different kind of a polaron. First of all, the coupling would not necessarily be short range there. So the phonons involved, would, as you said, would be Bogoliubov, acoustic Bogoliubov phonons with kind of linear dispersion.
Yeah.
So it is a kind of legitimate example of polarons, but they are not small polarons. They're very different type of polarons than what we have here.
Why is that?
Because, first of all, type of phonons is completely different. The type of coupling. No, here we are basically looking at nearly dispersionless. This is the typical typical optical phonons. Solids would look like this, right? So this would be your acoustic mode, but this would be your optical mode. And this optical mode you actually approximate with a completely dispersionless one because it actually never disperses much in solids. So this is totally different. So here we basically trying to simulate interaction to nearly dispersionless optical phonons, while what you said would correspond to simulate interaction with acoustic phonons, the ones that they have linear dispersion at small.
And that's totally different physics?
It's a different physics, yeah. First of all, you almost never, at least in solid-state systems, you never have strong coupling, a very very strong coupling to these kind of acoustic phonons as you have for to optical phonons. Mm-hmm. So if you talk about small polarons, it's usually, or almost always, it's optical phonons and it's systems with short-range interaction. Basically, non-polar materials.
That's this ansatz you mentioned doesn't work with this problem.
I don't think it would work with a case where you have like a pronounced dispersion and things like this. No.
Well, just one question related to his question. So in BCS, the electron phonon coupling, that's acoustic phonon, right?
Yes, that's acoustic phonons, and that's a phonon mediating interaction between two electrons, which is in totally different regime. It's actually very weak coupling. Yeah. While polaron is in a completely, when you talk about polarons, we most of the time talk about single particle problem, but this single particle is very strongly coupled to phonons, and the result of that is that you have this particle now heavily dressed into cloud of virtual phonons, and its effective mass can be like 30 or 50 times bigger than the bare carrier mass. There are examples in solid-state systems where the effective mass can be even larger, like in heavy fermion systems, it can be 500 times bigger than bare electron mass, but the polaron gets kind of close to that.
So are you aware of anyone studying, for example, some type of BCS but using optical phonon?
Not really, because I think that the optical phonons would not be able to mediate that kind of interaction. For that, you kind of need gapless acoustic-like phonon branch to be able to mediate interaction. You need like photon-like phonons, so to say.
The energies are different scale, right? It's for the phonons.
Yes.
So I have a question. In the earlier part of our program, we've had some long discussions about analog quantum simulation and versus digital, mm-hmm. and some questions related to basically the issues of robustness. So what is your feeling about the ability for an analog quantum simulator to push into a regime which is not simulatable, say, by a good classical ansatz and simulatable on a classical computer? What kind of requirements do you have on the physical device in terms of its control, its temperature, and so forth, that you can reach into that regime?
Okay, so I cannot say anything in general. I mean, I could imagine that there are systems where this issue is much more critical, like these quantum spin systems, etc., where you want to look at some really sharp features, some actual phase transition, mm-hmm. etc. For this problem, for instance, of polarons, you get very similar physics with, let's say, 3, 4, 5 ions, which you can definitely do even as we speak, as you would have for like 30 ions, because there's no sharp feature, there's no phase transition in these type of problems. So in that sense,
but does that mean that if we can access the same physics with the smaller dimensional system, then I could simulate it classically as well?
Yeah, well, actually here a classical simulation becomes difficult when you so you don't have to go to 30 sites to for your classical simulation to become difficult. It becomes difficult at 8 sites already. Mm-hmm. So this is something that, so there's one intermediate regime of system size that where actually you should be able to do something with the analog quantum simulation and computational treatment becomes already very difficult. I cannot say that this holds in general for any type of system. And one more comment is that, obviously, there are many things that are, so to say, not really exact in the sense that this Holstein model that we arrive at here is sort of effective model. So we do some things in the meantime, some steps like essentially integrating out transverse quantum modes and stuff. But this has to do more with this kind of intention to get to simulate this very idealized model, starting from the system which is a real physical system. Like in real physical systems, you don't really have completely dispersionless quantum modes, right? So this is the
One technical question. So as far as I see from these numbers, which is omegas and deltas, and so I have concern in a sense to make this adiabatic elimination of high excited states. So you need quite a lot of intensities, right? So the radio frequency, it's about 100 gigahertz. It's almost terahertz, right?
This is radio frequency, from 10 to... These kind of allowed regions, realistic values of parameters are given here. But as I emphasize in the next slide, actually this ratio, which could with these values go up to 10, we actually need only around 1 to actually to find small polarons. So we need about 10 times less than what would be actually reachable in experiments.
So it's visible in terms of
It's visible. It's perfectly feasible. Yes.
Because scattering it will not kill the system.
No. I mean, at least the numbers show that it will not.
And in terms of actually, I have a question about analog stuff. So I believe there's more critical scalability issue if you go to the higher number of sites here, for example. So the analog computer.
Sure. Well, I think there are broad questions, and we had some long discussions, and it's worth discussing some more of these issues about, you know, all the parameters in these models there, all set to some finite precision. And the question in my mind is, how do the errors propagate? That's to say, if I have small errors in the preparation, the evolution,
yeah, that's totally,
and the measurement,
yeah.
Then all of those errors are going to propagate in some way. Now, if the system is too hard for us to calculate, because I can't simulate it, then I don't know how those errors propagate into the final result. Now, there's some notion of universality in these systems. There's some notion that, but.
Yeah, I agree. That's a completely legitimate question.
There is a common lore. You quoted Norrie's paper, and you read Norrie says a quantum simulator clearly requires much less requirements on noise and control than a universal quantum computing. That's the common lore. We all kind of believe that, but I've never seen a proof of that. And I think it's important for us to understand as a community what is the computational power of an analog quantum device, because the computational power of analog classical devices can be off scale. If you have real numbers, you can compute NPR problems. So there's, I mean that this is a big question.
I know, it's a general question and completely legitimate. Yeah. We have to work on that, yeah.
So, but anyway, there's lots for us to think about.
Yeah.
Anyway, thank you very much.
Okay.
And we